Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Talking to you from a very fine presentation by Diana, who's just received an award. And I gave a presentation earlier today, which was great fun. And it's just incredible to listen to a master. And it's even more incredible to know that she is writing a ninth book. So hang in there, folk. And this is Davina Porter, and you're listening to the Outlander podcast.
Welcome to episode 114 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So that fabulous bumper is thanks to Lindsay J, who attended the Maryland Renaissance Fair. You can check out Lindsay's blog at www.winewordsandnerds.com. Thanks again so much, Lindsay. You are awesome.
And now on to this week's read-along. This week we are discussing chapter 29, which is 29, excuse me.
Or 28.
28, which is also, okay, here's what happened. Okay, my bookmark.
Wait, hold on. I'm totally jumping the gun here, but Mandy's like, what? I did not prepare for chapter 29.
No, my bookmark is in the spot of 29 because I finished 28. So when I opened the book, it automatically went to 29.
And why did you open the book there? Because of Jamie.
Because that's where my
Paka Jamie is.
He's my bookmark.
I know.
Anyway, this week we are discussing chapter 28, entitled The Coming of the Light.
And every time I hear that, I think of, go into the light, Caroline!
That's a weird thing to think.
Not really. Yeah. Into the light? No, I always think about that. Did you see Poltergeist in the 80s, Mandy?
Nope.
What? Did you see it in the 90s?
Nope. I don't do scary movies.
She doesn't like scary movies.
Oh, so you definitely would want to see the updated Poltergeist. Summer's
I'm kind of forcing it.
Oh, maybe not. Maybe I'm out of it.
Oh, no, you're going to see
I'm
it.
I'm going to
make
it.
Dude, we watched it the first time, the first one together.
When
we're
I was like
this one
eight.
Together, no. Which meant I was six, so.
No, there's no way we watched
it. Come on.
It. I just remember clowns and that, what is it, the tree going through the wall.
It's the little boy. Oh. There's
bodies in the pool.
Yeah, this is totally off topic. Let's come back together.
Let's go back to the actual light. Hold on.
I mean, I could probably start a dissertation on Poltergeist if we needed to, but let's talk about the chapter.
So let's start with the title. Connie shares, the chapter title has the word light. This chapter is chock full of allusions to darkness and light. She also discusses some biblical verses that mention light. Looking at these books through a Christian lens, as Diana surely does with her background, and as we've seen in Outlander, the passage from the Gospel according to St. John is very applicable. And she quotes, she gave a number of passages from John 1, verses 1 through 9. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So she shared a lot more, but I thought that was the most telling quote or verse because it shows not just the light and the darkness, but that the darkness cannot overcome the light. And that is definitely foreshadowing. Good description of what happens in this chapter.
And one more thing we should bring to light, because we haven't done it yet, is we forgot to mention that this week we are joined by our friend of the show, Mandy.
Hello. I was waiting.
I'm not embarrassed at all.
She's wearing a red hat and her face is just as red
very
as your
red.
Hat.
I'm very...
It's pretty awesome.
I am so sorry, Miss Mandy.
That's okay.
I'm just glad you're in Georgia and you can't whip me.
I'll be back in California soon
enough. Is that a
southern enough.
Thing?
Oh, sorry, what, Sam?
So is that a southern thing? That she's
whipping me?
She's whipping people?
No, I mean like with a wet noodle, you know, like a...
What? Is that a thing too?
Are you okay, Mandy?
I think so.
You know, like hit you with the wet noodle. You've never heard of that? Wet noodle? Beat you with a wet noodle? Okay. Lisa T. shares, the title, The Coming of the Light, is quite appropriate. The chapter begins with Claire hiding herself literally at Fontainebleau and figuratively hiding emotionally and mentally in the depths of dark depression. So Claire returns to Louise's house at Fontainebleau. She doesn't want anything to do with Jamie. She's done her part to secure his release, and basta. Louise does not ask her any questions. She was a good friend in this. Claire keeps to her room. She barely eats. She had had a purpose in going to Paris, but that was done. Now she had no direction. Diana uses the word rudderless. And when I read that, I thought, isn't that a term from the opening of the Stars series in episode 1? In the voiceover, Claire says something like, rudderless in an open sea. For some reason, that is really resonating with me. I swear it's in that opening when she talks about being lost. I think it's in the very beginning. It's when she's walking down that street before she looks at the vase or the vase. So she does try to put a face in, like going to some meals, going for walks, but it was all for Louise and for Fergus, the only person in the world, Diana writes, that she had some sense of responsibility for. LNG writes, well, leave it to Fergus to open up a crack in that grayness. So
I'm so not saying anything right now.
I know. I gotcha.
I have nothing good to say about that.
I stop right there. Okay. So she goes to see what's up when she hears his raised voice in an altercation. Something's going on with Wee Fergus. He and the stable lad were having an animated chat about the stable lad's mother.
Otherwise known as a fight.
Yes, or a fight. It came to blows, and the latter was on top of Fergus, choking him and banging his head against the ground. Basically, Claire comes up. The funny thing is,
I totally thought you said ladder as in the L-A-D-D-E-R. And I was like, there was a ladder on top of him and he was choking? I don't remember this.
Don't you know how those things work? So I thought there was nothing funny about the fight and nothing funny. It was kind of awesome about Claire, you know, kicking the dude in the britches to get him off of Fergus and basically save Fergus's life. But it's funny where she's still cloaked in that gray depression. And she comes out to see him. So she does come out with a good intention, but she stands there for a few seconds watching them do their thing. I guess it was just some mild spat. She didn't need to hop in, but it was just funny how she's just observing this and I was kind of thinking about going in or kind of thinking about not going in.
Well,
once she saw it was becoming bad.
You have to gauge things like that. You can't just jump in right away. You have to let the kids handle it themselves if they can, but if it's not working, then you do have to get in there and be a
parent. Kick some booty.
Yeah.
And can I also point out that I always learn new words when I read Diana's books?
Oh, yeah.
And so the new word for this book was, and I can't even really pronounce it, proboscis.
I think it's nose, right?
It is proboscis. Nose.
Yeah, it is nose. I always learn at least one new word in every Diana book.
Oh, at least. Oh, my gosh. Just one?
No, it's
in 800 pages?
Proboscis.
Proboscis. Mm-hmm. So she kicks him in the arse, basically, the stable lad, thus saving Fergus. His shirt and breeches, however, were torn. She sees a small red mark on his bare flesh because the seat of his pants is basically fallen away or coming off. And she notices it and recognizes it as a burn that has begun to heal. And she recognized the shape of the mark. And she asks Fergus, who did that to him? He tries to get away with blaming it on sledding off of a fence and, getting a big splinter. She's like, no. She recognizes a brand when she sees one. And she gets Fergus to tell his story. Now, is there anything you want to say before we start and jump in with the story?
I just want to say that I don't like this story.
Oh, my gosh. This was hard.
Well, it's the first of several things that just instantly make you flash back to Jamie and Wentworth. There's so many.
Oh, gosh.
I made a list. There's so many what I call reverse parallels in this chapter of things that are happening that are basically the opposite of things that were happening to Jamie in Outlander with Wentworth.
Oh, yeah. And some of our listeners, listener contributors pointed that out as well. And it is very. Yeah. I like your term for that, reverse parallel.
I just know that. This is the first time in this book where I started skim reading.
You're like, I don't need to do that.
I was like, I've
already seen it. Wait, the first time when you first read it, or the first time in the read-along that you're like, I don't need to do this?
This read-along.
Okay.
Where I started skim reading that whole section, because I was like, I
know what happens. I don't need to read again. So, we find out it was an Englishman with a ring. And it happened 3 months prior to this. And there's some mention, it may be later on in the chapter, that it's August and it's raining. So 3 months prior would be May. But we hear now that she says it was May. And it lined up, the timing lined up with Jamie's encounter with Jack Randall at that brothel. Fergus arrives, he said, and was told to wait by Jamie. He walks around because, like any young lad, he's going to do what he wants to do. He's not going to leave, but he's going to do what he wants to do basically in the room. And he spent years there, right? So he's comfortable and knows the kind of the routine and knows a lot of the women. And he walks around, and as he's in this other room, in comes the Englishman, flushed and untidy, eyes bloodshot. Now, listener Kelly G had a very interesting observation. I just thought, okay, it's the Englishman, we know who it is, and he's been partying or doing whatever too hard. But Kelly makes a good observation. She writes, while Jamie was engaged, BJR visited that same brothel. BJR was completely wasted. I thought this was interesting. BJR is usually so composed and not normally one disposed to getting rip-roaring drunk. I wonder what might have happened to make BJR lose control like this. Even during the worst of Wentworth, I don't recall BJR being drunk at all. It is curious. And I think that's a good point. I mean, you can say drunk or being wasted or whatever, but the whole point is, however he gets to lose control or gets to that point of not being in control is the opposite of the BGR that we know, who is in control. Maybe not calm, but he's cold and calculated and in control. So this is totally opposite. I can see that.
But wouldn't you think that this whole situation in France is a complete opposite of the situation in Wentworth? He's not in control anymore. He's not in England anymore. He's not really part of the sovereign group of that.
He's not in a position of power.
Right. Yeah. And he can't have Jamie under his thumb here. So, I mean, I think he was as heavily affected by what happened at Wentworth as Jamie was. It was something, a shared experience, not a great one, but a shared experience. And they were both changed because of it. And I think that him being here, I think he's still learning how to deal with the new change of things as well as everyone else. So, I mean, I don't like him, but he's going through his own little journey right now.
As an aside, I must say that I completely see, completely, even just reading this chapter where I'm envisioning what happened through Fergus telling his story, I see Tobias Menzies as BJR in every single way when I read or listen to this. That's the only character, though, that supplanted whatever image I had in my mind beforehand. Jamie and Claire are still kind of faceless to me. What do you guys, what about you guys? Have you had the characters supplant whatever you had in your mind before?
Yeah. I don't see faces when I read.
Me either, except now I see Tobias.
I see them all now. Like before?
No.
Before, because it's a first-person novel, I definitely put myself in the Claire character when I read. I just did, because it's all in first person. So, but then the other people, I don't think they had faces because it was just like more colors. Like it was a redhead and it was, you know, an a-hole. So, I mean, you have those kind of colorings.
Are you saying redheads are a-holes?
No, I'm saying okay. The BJR is an a-hole.
But he's not a redhead.
But he looks like an a-hole. So,
but he loves the color red.
Does. So, but once the actors were cast and we started the read-along, I know that when I started the read-along for the first book, the characters were beginning to look like them. I was putting their
faces.
As they
were cast?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was putting their faces in. And now that they've
embodied them?
And now that they've filmed the entire first book, basically, in my head, they've supplanted those characters.
Summer's stuck. She has no chance. No choice now.
People, yeah, I've never seen faces when I read books. Because, I mean, not just because I feel like I'm inside of Claire because it's a first-person, you know, narrative, I feel like I'm inside all of the characters, and so I'm looking out through their eyes rather than being external and observing the characters, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does to me, and I've never thought about why I see or don't see something, but I distinctly also do not see faces. That's why I'm kind of shocked. I guess since I go on about Tobias, I guess it doesn't surprise me that if there's one that I would supplant, it would be him. I don't know if that's subconscious or not, but that's the only one I see. I don't see anyone else.
That's because you're obsessed.
There's only one character I come close to seeing, and it's not Tobias. So
he tells Madame who his employer is and that he has to wait for him. It's interesting he doesn't say it's Jamie Fraser, though Fergus doesn't know that there's the relationship between Jamie and BJR. but he finds no support from Madame. She actually encourages him to go and says that, you know, look, I'll pay you some of the money if you go and just do this dude. Kelly G also wonders about BJR, so I thought it was funny that I was happy to see that I wasn't alone in wondering about this. She writes, I am trying to think if BJR had any idea or inkling that Fergus was connected to Jamie. I can't think of any reason why BJR would know that Fergus was under Jamie's protection. It may have been pure coincidence. From the text, I think we don't have anything in the text that... I think it has to be seen as a coincidence.
He's just a
boy. I don't think there's any reason to think that he knew that Fergus, you know, was connected with Jamie. I think he just saw something and wanted it, and then when Fergus started expressing reluctance, that just made it all the more attractive for him.
Well, yeah. And it breaks my heart as he is telling Claire this, quote, I knew the ones who like little boys don't usually take very long. I thought he would be finished long before Milord was ready to leave. To even have a child know what those words mean? I mean, dude, that...
Well, I mean, it's easy to forget that he grew up in a brothel, which means he was probably exposed to a lot of things that most little, 9-10-year-olds are not exposed to, nowadays at least, hopefully.
Yeah, I think reading that part, him telling that story, is as anything else in the book.
Yeah.
Like I said, I had a real hard time reading this.
Summer just skimmed it.
I skimmed it.
Claire is shocked and asks him if he'd done it before, because he's like, how would you know about this unless you maybe have experience? So Fergus looks as though he wants to cry and replies, not very often, madame. There are houses where this is a specialty, but sometimes a customer would see me and take a fancy. And just reading that, and I... obviously didn't do any accent and wasn't trying to act or anything, but just as I was reading that out loud, I am reminded of Davina's narration of that, because I've listened to this week at least twice. Oh, her little Fergus voice, it breaks your heart even more. In addition to the text, what's being said, how she says it, good Lord. And then we get the... the line that we probably don't need to say, but then Fergus says, he was much bigger than I thought. I asked I asked him if I could take him in my mouth, but he but he wanted to ... So Claire, at this point, Claire pulls him to her, cutting off the rest of what he's saying. You know, thank goodness, Claire. So he is convinced, Fergus, that it's his fault. During this thing, he cries out.
I always assumed that he cried out when he actually was being branded.
I think you're right, because while it may have been painful and may have been extremely uncomfortable, the actual act, I think it was obviously the branding is your burnings. You know, burns are like some of the worst types of injuries to have. So I think you're right. I've never actually thought of that, but I think you're right. Jamie finds him with BJR and punches him. Now, Fergus runs out, hides in a closet. When Jamie finds him later, he's in such shock and he's still shaking so badly that he can't even do his buttons up, and Jamie has to dress him. Poor Fergus feels so incredibly guilty. This is so hard to read. I don't know if it's harder to read the fact that he's recounting this or the fact that he feels guilty for Jamie having to be sent away. I mean... It's heartbreaking is what it is.
Yeah, but it's so common for children to feel like things are their fault, even when it's not.
Yeah, that is true.
Whereas I have the exact opposite. Nothing is ever my fault.
Because you're not a children.
I'm not a children.
We know they have to keep something in the Starz adaptation of Dragonfly and Amber in the series for Jamie to break his word to Claire. So there has to be some motivation for him to do that, since we know they keep the duel. But I know they have Fergus, but who knows? I wonder, and Mandy and I don't know if Summer, but Mandy and I have talked offline about this actually quite a bit, and I've seen it in different groups and everything. People are wondering, and I think rightly so. I wonder just how much, or if they'll keep this particular act as the motivation.
I don't know. I mean, there's just no way to know.
I mean, there is one way to know, and that is we wait till it airs.
Well, yeah.
But other than that, I think they kind of... don't have to leave it in, but I think it's the best reason for Jamie to go against his word. Like, I can't think of a better reason. I can't think of something else they could supplant that with that would be as meaningful.
The reason I say I wonder if they can keep this is not because I don't want them to, not because I don't think they should. I'm just thinking of this 10-year-old actor. Obviously, I'm not talking about showing an act. But to have a 10-year-old, or however old he is, 10, 11, whatever, have to have some of this language is still, I mean, he's an actor, but he's quite young. I just don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, they do it in movies and TV shows all the time.
Yeah, oh, I know.
That's true. But he's a little angel. He is. He's so cute.
Okay. So Lori, and it's her first time contributing. Welcome, Lori. At the beginning, when Claire learns what BGR did to Fergus, it not only breaks your heart for Fergus and shows what he has had to endure in his life, especially to learn it wasn't the first time he had to do it, but we can finally understand why Jamie broke his word to Claire. And like Summer just said, this is about the only thing. Because Jamie, once he gives his word, he's done. He's solid. It takes something this massive.
Yeah, to this point, Claire's been very comfortable with laying all the blame for what happened with Faith on Jamie because of him breaking that promise.
Exactly.
And now she's having to reevaluate what happened. And to me, that's where you start seeing the first cracks in this little insulated cocoon that she's built around herself with the depression.
Oh, yeah. And we'll get to that, too, because it's quite major. Connie writes, BJR branded Fergus when he sodomized him at Madame Elise's brothel. And then Connie says, this is pure or idle speculation. I wonder if they saved the prosthetic brand that was cut out and, quote, thrown into the fire in episode 16 of Outlander, and if they will use it again in season 2.
I think they'll recreate it, but I mean, that's kind of...
I imagine it wouldn't be exactly the same brand because...
I mean, like the same piece of putty.
Well, not only that, but I mean, every burn is different, even with the same implement.
Yeah.
I mean, if they hit it from a different angle, it would just sit differently depending upon where it was in his body. So I think it would make sense to recreate.
I'm sure it'll be modeled on the way it looked before. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
at least
it would
the
have
ring
to
part.
Based on
well,
their,
yeah.
Yeah.
So then she quotes, my voice sounded queer to my own ears, preternaturally calm and detached. She shares, having had such an experience, I infer from her description in the line above, what I just read, that Claire is somewhat in a state of clinical shock at this point, feeling outside herself because she is having a difficult time coming to grips with the myriad implications of this discovery. I mean, yeah, that's putting it, I think, correctly. Claire is in even deeper apathy. Quote, the gray cloud that had surrounded me since the miscarriage seemed to draw closer, wrapping me in swaddling folds that dimmed the light of the brightest day. Sounds seemed to reach me faintly, like the far-off ringing of a buoy through fog at sea. And about this, Connie shares, Louise says Claire is too thin and compares Claire's pale, wan appearance, quote, as white as a plate of tripes. Now, Connie also shared the link. I mean, you can Google it too, but Connie shared a link to a Wikipedia article about tripe, and I put a picture in my notes, but then when I emailed them to Summer, she didn't get the beauty of the picture. So let's bring up that picture.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I know what it looks like. I'm good.
I mean, it wasn't an uncommon dish for the time.
Nope. People still eat it today. I'm just
exactly.
You know, it's just wow.
You didn't waste things if they were edible.
Oh you know, gosh. It looks like they look like deflated bow. You know those like dumplings, like
I don't
Asian dumplings.
I don't eat
dumpling. I don't eat dumpling.
There's usually meat in them.
Well, yeah, but like the Asian dumplings, they just look kind of like deflated. Dumplings.
I can't look at it.
But I know what it is, which means that just makes it not appetizing at all.
So we'll share that. No, actually, we will not put that picture on our post.
Now, for those unwilling that don't want to go look for that and hunt for it, tripe is stomach
of typically
a cow,
beef,
right?
Yeah,
it's a cow stomach.
I think there's different types of tripe. So because the picture I saw kept saying like beef tripe. So if you have to use the word beef, I'm sure it can be a different kind of tripe. But Maybe I'm wrong. If there's more than one type of tribe, let us know.
But please don't send me to any. Send it to me.
Oh, gosh. No. The scene where Claire is basically spaced out, yet she observes the flies alighting on her breakfast. Louise trying to get rid of them, and the maid hitting them with a swatter. And putting the dead ones in her apron pocket.
Yummy.
And then polishing the smear they made on the table with her apron.
I can't imagine anybody eating after that.
I know. Louise suggests that she go for a walk to the arbor to see if there are any muskets left so she could, that she can eat. That's a type of grape. Yeah.
Delicious.
And Connie writes, "Depressed Claire don't care." The grayness followed her inside and out. Louise had to take care of something in the house, so Claire continues alone outside. It was a cool day, we learn. There had been rain. Pools of water lay in her path. Trees dripped water. The sky was gray. Quote, "It looked as though the sun might come out soon, but it was still cold enough to want a cloak." So this is the first hint of the word sun, but she's still saying. So there's a hint the sun may come out, but it's still cold enough to have a cloak. She's cloaking and wrapping herself in this grayness, and there's a hint of coming sun. And in the exact next paragraph, who shows up? The sun. In the form of Jamie Fraser, who is, it's alluding to Jamie, obviously. I mean, it's literally, I'm like, whoa, hot dang, that's the next chapter. I mean, the next paragraph. The second footman comes after her to let her know that she had a visitor. She didn't want one. She finds out it was Jamie. She turns and sees Jamie, then continues down the path she had been going, full on pretending she hadn't seen him. And he calls after her, and he gets closer. She feels threatened at this point. Quote, "The soft gray numbness around me quivered, and I felt a sort of frozen panic at the thought that the sight of him might rip it away from me. If it did, I would die, I thought, like a grub dug up from the soil and tossed onto a rock to shrivel, naked and defenseless in the sun." Lisa T. juxtaposes that quote beautifully with this one from Outlander. "Now it's like my own little fortress has been blown up with gunpowder. There's nothing left of it but ashes and a smoking roof tree. And the little naked thing that lived there once is out in the open, squeaking and whimpering in fear, trying to hide itself under a blade of grass or a bit of leaf. But not making much of a job of it."
I have that exact quote written down.
You do, bless your heart. Woohoo! Go, Lisa.
Also, I have, because Claire tries to run because deep down inside she knows that the only thing that would make her come back to life fully, that involving pain and everything else, would be Jamie.
Absolutely.
And she knows. And so she's trying to outrun Jamie, thinking she can outrun the pain.
Well, she's also, this cocoon she's created for herself has numbed her.
Right.
And
protected her,
and
too.
And it's a protective numbness, and she's like, I just want to feel anything. And if I'm going to feel anything, I don't have to grieve anymore, and I don't have to think about these things. But if she allows him back in,
she has to feel.
She has to face everything and feel everything all over again. And I don't think that she ever really processed any of the things that happened to her.
Lisa continues, "Both Claire and Jamie have been shattered to the depths of their naked souls. Jamie could not heal without Claire, and we see in DIA that Claire cannot heal without Jamie. They have both sacrificed themselves completely for the other. Claire's depression and anger is reminiscent of Jamie's at the end of Outlander. In chapter 28, we begin to see Jamie trying to heal Claire in his own way, with his warmth, love, and understanding. Despite her intense fear of being naked and defenseless in the sun, she, quote, lifts her head and looks full into the face of the sun."
The second one of those reverse parallels I was talking about.
Oh, exactly, the wedding. Exactly. Connie writes, "Within depression, there's a sort of feeling of safety within the pain. A great deal of inertia is also involved, immobilizing the sufferer and keeping him or her in the same condition. We become accustomed to the pain we know and fear the pain that may come with healing. I can relate to Claire's description here." He tries to continue toward the arbor, but he confronts her. She tries to continue toward the arbor, but he confronts her. Besides calling her name, his first words to her are, "Claire, it was my child, too." Ellen G. writes, "The first sentence from his mouth, 'Claire, it was my child, too,' tears my heart out. I cannot wait to see this scene, hopefully, next season.
Just off topic here. We have a lot of listeners, apparently, who write in that have the last initial of G. It sounds like we have a bunch of, like, DJs or rappers.
And I'm Loquacious
G. That's so. Right. So we got, like...
So, yo, yo.
Ellen
what
G.
What up, Loquacious?
Who's the other new G we've got this week?
Mandy's laughing at my bad rapping skills.
So bad.
No, I was just going to say, other than the framing story, this is hands down the scene that I'm looking forward to the most.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because, yeah, can we get a what for the framing story? I know we have no pool and no connection whatsoever, but if I could have one thing on a list of a gajillion, it would be framing story, besides DIA, which we're getting, it would be framing story. And
I'm
agree with you.
It'll be there.
Oh, sorry. I just lost myself a little bit.
I want a season 3.
But what I was going to say is I was in Scotland this time last year.
Okay, stop bragging, girl. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say one of the places that I visited was Pollock House in Pollock Park. And Pollock House has a very French formal garden next to it. And the only thing I could think of as I was going through that garden was that would be a perfect, you know, setting for this scene.
Oh, wow.
If you remind me, I'll give you a picture and you can post it on the webpage.
Ooh, yes, okay. Please. Yes, please. She's defensive. Yes, it was, she says, and you killed it. She goes into the area through the arch, not realizing it was an enclosed space, and she was trapped. Quote, the light behind me failed as his body blocked the arch.
You know, it always strikes me, the people who you love the most are the people that you have the most power to hurt. And it's like, why are you looking at me? Don't do that. Clearly, I don't love you enough because I don't hurt you well. my point is it's like it's like she's going out of her way to say the things that will cause the most pain, and she it's like that scene in Steel Magnolias at the funeral when Sally Fields Malin, the character, is just like, I just want to hit someone until they feel as bad as I do. Thank you. But I just want to hit somebody until they feel as bad as I do. And I feel like that's what she's doing. She's like, I don't think you've suffered enough. I don't think you feel as bad as I do. You didn't go through this. And
but you also don't do that to people unless you trust them enough to know that they will take it.
Yeah.
And not leave you. Exactly.
Right.
She's deep in her struggle against losing the grayness. Quote, I could feel my gray wrappings being inexorably stripped away. And small, bright streaks of pain shot through me like lightning bolts piercing a cloud. Such wonderful imagery of the weather and her protective coverings. Lots of comparisons there. As he forces her to confront him, he didn't even know, he says, the sex of the baby. She looks up and he is sitting on the gravel at her feet. And so, whereas earlier in the chapter, it was Fergus's time to confess. Now it's her time. Maybe not. Maybe confession is not the right word, but in a way it kind of is. You know, she is letting this off of her soul. So in a way, it's painful because she has to confront it, right? That's the whole point of her not wanting to be with Jamie, because he's making her face this. And if she has to face him, she has to face it. So it's just all painful for her all the way around. So she tells him. This is Claire's confession, if you will.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Until this point, we didn't even know the sex of the baby, correct?
I thought I remember Mother Hildegard. I don't think we knew it was Faith, but I thought I remember Mother Hildegard telling her it was a girl.
But I don't remember.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm remembering it as what we hear here. So she tells him it was a girl. Mother Hildegard had baptized her Faith. She says, quote, my eyes were open all the way now. She's finally speaking to the person she has been terrified of seeing, about the subject she's not wanted to dredge up, and she is in her truth. So having her eyes open all the way is another, of course, symbolic also of her facing the light, basically. She also describes the baby. The light shone through her skin. A lot of light symbolism in this chapter, no? Like father, like child? And Kelly G. also thought that was interesting. She says, Claire's description also mentions how light shone from Faith. A small callback to the title of the chapter, perhaps? Claire remembers her healing by Master Raymond and how only Jamie's hold on her could bring her back, but she was afraid to feel again, to be completely alive again, and she didn't want to lose love again. quote, but it was too late. I knew that, even as I fought to hold the gray shroud around me, and, quote, I could feel the light coming, blinding and searing. And then more imagery as of Jamie as the light. Quote, he had risen, and standing over me, his shadow fell across my knees. Jamie begs to give her comfort. She asks harshly if he can bring back her child. And of course he says no, but with the grace of God, I might give you another. She feels the warmth of his skin and other things. Grief, anger, fear, and his courage. Then maybe one of my favorite lines from this book, and one, indeed one of the entire series, is what I've tweeted about a few times now. Quote, I gathered my courage around me, a flimsy substitute for the thick gray shroud. Then I took his hand and lifted my head and looked full into the face of the sun. Ellen G. writes, the face of the sun! Wow! Then they just sat together in silence until Jamie could tell his story. Claire did feel the emotions through his body and his words, and now it's Claire's chance to comfort him. My heart aches to see this scene. This is still part of the scene that you were talking about that could be, because it's just the next portion of the same scene in the garden, right, or in the arbor. This is also, to use Mandy's term, maybe not an exact reverse parallelism, but in a way it kind of mirrors that confession at, well, in the series it wasn't at the stones, but the confession when she says, I'm not a witch, I'm a time traveler, basically. It's her, again, a form of her confessing, you know, lightening her burden, and she's telling him who she really is. Well, here they're in nature, they're alone. Her letting this off allows her to. The circumstances are completely different, but it allows her to get to the next step. At least in this book, obviously, to heal, and. It is similar, not in the information revealed, but in its iconic nature. Like you were saying, book two is known for France. It's known for, obviously, what happens at the end. But it's known for this. I think it's known for this scene, besides the framing story, like you said.
Yeah, well, I've got the two notes I have for this particular section are, number one, if you can read the description that Claire gives about faith without crying, I'm not sure I trust you as a human being.
I can't.
And number two, and I think we're at this part, I'd have to look specifically which page, is there's a moment where when they're sitting outside after they're reconnecting then, where Jamie pulls his cloak around Claire, mm-hmm. because she's cold, reminds me, again, it's a parallel to when they were together at Lollybrock, sitting on the fence, and that he tells her, or I think that's when he tells her that he married her for love the first time he tells her that, and she pulls her cloak around him. Mm. It was such a flashback to that moment.
Man, that's a whole other, like, show. Parallels between the first... I mean, goodness Lord. All these connections. Because, you know, Diana talks about the shapes of her novels, right? The shapes... Mm-hmm. But that's just the shape of one novel in and among itself. Just as a construction, as a work of art.
This one was a dumbbell, wasn't it?
Yes, dumbbell. Like Mandy has said, there are obvious and maybe not so obvious parallels between the two books, but that's like a course in and of itself to take the time to kind of look at two books together. You know what I mean? What I'm trying to say is we could do that for maybe not all eight books. It gets harder and harder to do because they get so intertwined and so long.
Well, it's why it takes her so long to write one of these books.
Well, because she's doing exactly this.
Craft them.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. So Lori shares, when Jamie says, please let me give you comfort, I am so happy she doesn't pull away, but takes his hand and they can begin to comfort each other and heal. They sit for a while under the grape leaves, just being with each other. When she finally turns to him, she says, Jamie, oh, Jamie, where were you?
Wherefore art thou, Jamie?
Well, Jamie, quite frankly, thought she was dead, and he had seen her covered in blood after she had collapsed, and he's taken away by the guard, so he's not allowed to sit to stay and accompany her to l'hôpital. Kelly G. writes, one question I still have is why BJR isn't punished for dueling. I mean, it takes two to tango, right? If dueling is against the king's command, wouldn't both be punished?
Maybe it's just they only punish the person who...
Who does the challenge?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Because there would have been no duel if That's they true. Hadn't challenged.
Yeah.
Or maybe they only punish the victor. Because don't you
or
think he was kind of punished
there
enough?
Wasn't some kind of punishment for
That's
for
true.
True.
And
this happens off screen and we don't hear about it.
Yes. And the first thing that popped into my mind, even though it may not be the exact same, he might be under a type of diplomatic immunity because he is working for...
Yeah, but Jamie was working for the Bonnie Prince, so I mean...
Yeah, but he's not recognized.
Who'd have thought if anybody could have gotten him out of it?
But he's not recognized. The Duke of Sandringham is there and recognized and entertained and everything by the king. So he's, like, on an official visit, or at least if he's officially recognized. The prince is like, nobody has bad love for that prince.
No.
Except Louise.
and BJR was also stabbed in the junk, so he didn't come off...
Scot-free. Oh. I didn't even... Yeah, we gotta look that term up, scot-free. I wonder... Yeah, okay. So he weeps, and she tries to tell him it's all right. He said he had tried bashing his head against the wall in the Bastille, but they tied him up hand and foot so he wouldn't do that. And de Rohan visited him the next day. I'm guessing since it probably wasn't Louise, must have been her husband, that told him she was alive, but maybe not for long. He apologizes to Claire again, but she tells him that she understands why he did it. She asks him if he were told why he was released, and he replies he knows only that it was the king's pleasure. And Claire's
boy,
like, yeah, he knows. He knows. What's up?
I said, boy, howdy.
Boy, howdy. So he had visited Mother Hildegard as well. So he if he didn't know, he found out. So Connie writes, after his release, Jamie went to Mother Hildegard and learned what happened about the baby and that Claire had gone to the king. We learned that Jamie had seen... we learned that Jamie had seen the king's penis at the levee, quote, that the damn filthy stubby thing, and had visualized the king using it on Claire. Kelly G writes, he walked from Paris to Fontainebleau, which I think is almost 43 miles. Wow.
If you're going to call them with their last initial and it's G, you're going to have to say it with a little more like stank. Like
stank?
Kelly G.
I don't do that, stank.
Kelly G said.
She tries to tell him what happened while she was there, but he won't let her get a word in edgewise. She interrupts him and tells him what happened with the sorcerer's duel and the death of Le Comte. I love the line of Claire's when she says, quote, didn't know what you were starting with that silly story, did you? Meaning, of course, the La Dame Blanche thing. Port, the whole point of this trip with Murta is safe. He ended up being the one with the smallpox, with the fake smallpox instead of Murta, because
well,
I guess it didn't work
sick.
On Murta.
Well, it didn't matter. If
oh,
it
no, you're
worked.
Right.
He was already sick, and he wasn't going to be of any use to anybody. He wouldn't be able to negotiate anything when he was... dying in a hammock.
Jamie retains his sense of humor when he talks about having to wait half a day while the captain haggled over the price. Quote, and me dying in my hammock, pissing blood and puking my guts out. I wonder if the grapes are symbolic of anything. Water. The only thing I thought of was like water into wine.
It's like baby wine. That's what I think.
I mean,
grapes, someday they'll grow up and be wine.
Okay.
All I can think is poor Jamie and his seasickness.
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah, totally. So Louise suggests that she go out there and... Whoa, hold on. I wonder if the grapes are symbolic of anything. All I think of is like water into wine. Louise had suggested that she go out there and see if there were any that left that she could eat originally. And then she and Jamie having their reuniting under them and then chatting under them for so long. So, you know, like with
you
the trees...
Googled it.
I didn't actually.
Did you wiki it?
No, I didn't do anything.
Somebody else did it for you?
No.
You gonna do it right now?
No.
Okay.
So I'm just curious, because when she places them under a tree or something, it usually has some significance, as we found. Or at least, I overthink it. But either way. So in bed, Jamie's asleep. She remembers the conclusion of the meeting with the king. They left the room, went to the green chaise, and fulfilled their agreement. He had to use rose oil on her since she was not ready. I'll leave it at that. The oddest thing is that they bow to each other after the transaction. As she left, She was thinking how she would like to rub Jamie's nose in the scent of roses until his soul sickened and died. Quote, and I let the door close forever on His Majesty's audience.
I just think to myself, if that's a common transaction he has, how, like, STD-ridden is the king? Like, for real.
Well, STDs were pretty common in the French court.
That's my point. Claire could have just, like, walked away with an extra present.
Yeah.
You know, the gift that keeps
but
on
you
giving.
Know, going back to the symbolism of the grapes and everything, you know, grapes are turned into wine through time and pressure into something stronger. And that's kind of what's happened to Jamie and Claire's relationship in this chapter. Through time and pressure, they've been converted into something stronger than what they started with.
I like that. That's what do you think about that as like a?
I mean, I brought up title. Wine first.
No. Something stronger.
She just made it pretty.
That's because you don't like whiskey.
You're right.
There you go. What do you think about that for a title? Something stronger?
I don't know.
No.
We'll think about it.
Not resonate with you? Okay.
I still like the king's pleasure. We already used that one.
Well, for it to be the king's pleasure, he seemed to get damn little of it.
I know. And I get why he didn't finish, but I just thought that whole thing was weird. I'm like, I don't know who he was doing that for. It was clearly a symbolic.
It was like, I'm doing it because I can do it. And she's
well, I think it was,
Dame Blanche.
That was the agreement. And, yeah. You know, he couldn't be seen to be giving something away for free, so to speak. So if she was going to trade her body for Jamie's freedom, the whole transaction had to take place. He couldn't just let Jamie go and say, oh, yeah, don't mind the rest of it.
Kelly G. writes, now as she lies beside Jamie, she instead decides to close the door on what happened with the king. She believes she can keep this from Jamie forever. She could use it to torment him, but decides she will not. It is comical at this point for Claire to believe she can keep this from Jamie, as it is known that Claire has a glass face and anyone can read her true feelings.
Well, they can read her true feelings, but they can't read, like,
well, Jamie's already
memories.
Said he knows what happened.
Yeah, with the tone of his voice, he knew exactly what pleasure meant.
Yeah, but she could totally be like, dude, it was teeny, it was not good, and you're so much better.
But he's already
you're
seen
better
it.
That you're the king, you're my king,
bad about it.
Who feels bad about it? She does?
I think Claire thinks Jamie deserves to feel a little bit bad about it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, she didn't feel bad. She really didn't feel bad about it. Like, when she was leaving, she was like, I want to rub his face in it.
I know.
I want to I wish he was here just so I could rub his face in it. So, I don't know. I think she doesn't really feel that bad about it. She may feel bad about it later, but, you know, it was very...
like in about a chapter? I don't know.
Maybe. I'm just saying, it's like...
For whatever reason, and y'all can cut this out later if you want to, but for whatever reason, when I read that part where she talks about rubbing his face in it, all I can think of is that scene in Outlander where the first time they have oral sex, and she said, well, you should have just rubbed my face there first time, and everything would have been fine.
That is, but that's only in the book, though, right? That wasn't in the show.
Right, yeah.
Okay, just checking. I was like, they left that out. When he was like, I should have rubbed my... What he does with horses, his oxter.
Oh, there I had downtown Frank.
What?
Lori writes, I was very surprised to read the end of the chapter the first time and hear about what happened after the Comte died at Versailles. And I can see that while she did what she had to do to save the man she loves, despite everything that had happened, that she was also very angry at having to do it. But now that Jamie was there, she is finally able to forgive him and let that anger go and move on with the rest of their lives.
However long or short that may be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she did it knowing full well that he would be upset about her doing it.
Well, she also intended to never see him again.
If
you start this chapter, she's like, I'm never going to see him again. I'm done.
You know, to borrow a phrase from another group of analysts, I think that's unreliable narrator Claire. She knew darn well she would see him again. She tells herself that, but she doesn't believe it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't believe it because there was a whole bunch of book left. He was bound to show up again.
Susan P. wraps the chapter up. This is most definitely a loaded chapter. So much has happened. Claire's lost her child, which she'd all but given up thinking she could even have. In the 1700s, no less. She's brokenhearted over Jamie as well. The only reason she's still there, or I should say, yes, still there, but the only reason she stayed. She's had a, quote, transaction with the King of France and dealing with this entire wearing clothes equivalent to, sorry, and dealing with this entire thing wearing clothes equivalent to a German, German tanker and people with mindset from 250 years ago, not to mention a wisp of a little French street urchin whom she's just discovered was marked and abused by the same monster that nearly destroyed the love of her life. And no medication. How she eludes alcoholism is miraculous. Excuse me, another miracle. Then there's Fergus. We all know by now that such atrocities still abound in current times, and no doubt it wasn't uncommon knowledge then. But I somehow doubt that it was circa 1946, that rude awakening on top of the revelation that it was the catalyst for Jamie's, quote, betrayal, is like putting kerosene in an oven. Kaboom. And yet Claire goes out for a walk. Breaks up a fight. The kicking part was helpful, certainly, and forgives Jamie. And they all have a nice dinner and go to bed. You know, perfectly normal.
Yeah.
So that's a doozy of a chapter. Actually, maybe that might be a better title. This one's a doozy. No doozy?
No. It was a good chapter. It was good in the fact that it finally got the two characters back together because don't like them apart. And every time... And this is in all the books. My least favorite parts are the parts when they're not together. Just because,
you know, I think it's a well known secret now that Dragonfly and Amber is my least favorite of all of the Outlander books.
Yes.
But this is the part of it that I do like a lot. I don't care for the France parts in general. I love the framing story. I like this part, and then I like the rest of the book that takes place in Scotland. But most of the French court stuff, I don't care for.
I liked it for the change of scenery and for the fact that they were, it seemed, not on the run for a while. You know, it was almost peaceful for a time. It was kind of mirrored their time in Lollybrock, where they were kind of lord and lady again, and they were in the pomp and circumstance of all of that. And so in that regard, it was nice to have that little respite, but then it went from being that nice little respite and everything was going along swimmingly to, like, everything went to hell in a handbasket over the course of a few chapters. And it was like everything hit at once. Jamie dueled, got put in prison, and Claire lost the baby. They all hate each other, and then, you know, they finally are getting back together and we're getting back to, you know, these two main characters. So I'm happy to be past this part.
I think we kind of said it, but, I mean, actually, the bulk of the chapter happens in the arbor, right? Well, there's the Fergus outside near the stable, and then, or wherever they are, and then there's the part in the arbor, right? That's, like, basically the two settings, the two chunks of this chapter.
And then bed.
That's true, and then bed. Not a lot happens in bed.
She just recollects. Lots of stuff happened in bed.
Not in this chapter.
Okay.
She just recollects what happened with the king. So that was, like, a tiny, tiny chunk. But, yeah, there's a... Head.
But if you think about it, that part where she's talking, recollecting what happened with the king, that takes place in the dark. Because she's still trying to keep that hidden.
Oh, yeah. That's true. There's a lot of light and dark play here.
With the way the last chapter ended, I started to think that perhaps the transaction was her killing the Comte. Her being the Dame Blanche for the king. So the way the last chapter ended, it made me think that was the transaction. So until the end of this next chapter, the chapter that we just finished, I didn't even realize that they'd done the whole thing.
Oh yeah, I think Diana does that deliberately.
Yeah,
she lets you think that it's going to play out one way, and then you find out there really was a higher price to pay.
Oh my gosh, all the prices to pay, all the books. Yeah, whoo, some doozies we've got waiting for us, girls. Whoo.
Well, that wraps up chapter 28, the Coming of the Light. Be sure to join us for our next chapter for the read-along when we will be discussing chapter 29, To Grasp the Nettle.
That may sting.
I mean, nettles generally do.
Before we leave... Sorry?
I said, and leave rashes.
Oh, yes, that too. I was about to say, before we leave, another huge... thank you to our good friend Mandy for joining us again.
Mandy, where can you be found online?
Oh, yeah. Mandy, do you have a little site maybe somewhere, just maybe?
I do. I can be found at thegreatscottblog.com, which I have been very lax in updating in Droughtlander. So I need to get the post up now that Agave did finally come back and tell me what Jamie says at the end of that deleted scene. There. So Scott-a-orched.
Very nice. Which
is apparently a very good way to say F you.
Oh. Nice. I need to put that in my lexicon.
Well, thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.